Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 115th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. That is John Rauhaus playing in the background. He has a new record coming out with Eric Bachman that I encourage you to check out. I thought it was fantastic. And on this podcast today, we have a fantastic interview with Jim Olson. Jim Olson is a legend. He is one of the great guitar makers. You've seen his guitars in the hands of James Taylor and Phil Keaggy and Leo Kottke. And he is up there in Minnesota just making ridiculously great guitars. They command top dollar, and to put the icing on the cake, he kind of thinks they're overpriced. He's a super humble guy. He doesn't really get this. I was just happy as a clam to be able to talk to him. We cover a lot of ground. James Taylor, of course, the development of his guitars, and a lot more. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be in 1 minute. I do just want to mention issue 36 of the Fretboard Journal. Irvin Somogyi, Derek Trucks, Bob Bain, David Berkowitz, another fine luthier, are all in that issue. It is available on fretboardjournal.com right now. You can subscribe, which we would love, or you can order the single issue from us, but that's probably your best way to get it, or you can go to your local newsstand or fine guitar shop and look for it there. But that is out now, and we're hard at work cranking out issue 37. It's going to be another great issue, and that'll be out in September. Go to fretboardjournal.com for any details on that. We also reference in this podcast, as I'm talking to Jim, Drew Heinonen, who is building us our Fretboard Summit guitar. If you have been listening to this podcast, you probably know all about that, but we're going to be unveiling that guitar. We're actually going to be doing a live Fretboard Journal podcast from the summit, unveiling that guitar and talking to Drew. That'll be at the Fretboard Summit October 14th through 16th, and we still have tickets available for that. So if you want to go and rub shoulders, talk shop, listen to some of the brightest minds in the world of guitar making and guitar playing, as well as banjo making and banjo playing and mandolins too, go to fretboardsummit.com. It is our unique, one-of-a-kind gathering that happens every year. We did one last year and had so much fun. It is a truly mind-boggling and mind-blowing event where we can just go and kind of bring the pages of the Fretboard Journal to life. It is not a typical guitar show by any means. It is not luthiers or vintage dealers standing around tables. It is where you can actually hang out and talk to these guys and have a blast. So go to fretboardsummit.com. And we'll be recording the last of these Fretboard Summit Guitar Build podcasts live, which I'm really excited about. Without further ado, here's the one and only Jim Olson. Thanks so much for tuning in. Jim, we've been talking about you. I don't know if you know this, but we've been building a guitar with Drew Heinonen and talking all about you. And I wanted to actually talk to you, so thank you very much.
No problem, Jason.
So let's cut to the chase for anyone listening. What's your current wait list right now, and what are the odds of getting a guitar from you?
Well, you know, I'm getting older, Jason. I'm 66 here, and I'm trying to cut back and not kill myself. So I actually won't take any more orders than I can fill per year. So, I'm only going to build 20 instruments this year, and I don't have a backlog past that, and I'm not accepting any orders past that. So, unfortunately, I probably had 50 people wanting 20 spots this year, and I don't tell them no. I just keep pushing them back and tell them get back to me sometime. I don't really keep a wait list. If I did, it's just too complicated to keep track of how many are still interested. So it's kind of being in the right place at the right time, which isn't fair, but I don't know how else to handle it at this point. So
yeah. And how does it work? Do you send out an email or something?
No, I'm not even doing that, honestly. Okay. All I'm telling people is get back to me. This batch will get done, somewhere around October, November, and I'll start making parts for next year. I tell them to get back to me, and I'm kind of just picking and choosing, which, again, isn't fair. If somebody wants something that's out of my wheelhouse, they're probably less likely. I tried to keep lists, and they got so big that nobody would get on them, to be honest with you. And then also, when you have a list, you got to go and email, and then they go, I'm interested. I'll let me get some time to think about it, and I'll get back to you. And you know, then the process starts. Can we do this? Would that? Would this color purfling? And it just gets kind of convoluted. So I haven't even been keeping a list. I tell people that. I tell them just get back to me in the fall, and we'll see how things look. And it's real possible, Jason, that I might not take custom orders anymore and just turn this back into a hobby and make what I want, when I want, and you know, how I want, and then sell them when they're done. I've been saying that for 5 years. I'm not sure it'll ever happen, but it would kind of be an ideal retirement situation to just make them without the pressure of sending out updates, photos, and you know, dealing with all of the things that come with having 20 people wanting you to jump, you know. I could do it at my own pace and sell them when done. So we're going to see. I don't know. I'm sure I'll have to take some next year, but because they're all such good people and close friends in many cases, hard to say no.
Now, I know your guitars are currently command a high price. Man. Have you thought about raising that price?
You know, it's already too high. You know, I'm really embarrassed by it. And I held that price from 2000 to 2014, 14 years. And I only had no price increase during that time. And I only raised it because I was trying to match what the used market went. And by no means did I drink my own Kool-Aid here and think these guitars are that valuable, worthy, or anything else. It's just happenstance that I kind of, like the Forrest Gump of guitar making, fell into here, and the demand is so high that you know, I don't think these things are any more special than anything else. I'm very thankful that the artists that play them feel they are, but I'm not puffing out my chest about this. I think they're already priced pretty high, you know. So you could do that, raise it up and scare people away. But I built some crazy high-priced ones where I put extra abalone and the tree mahogany or whatever, and those command really high prices, and people pay them. So I'm flattered and flabbergasted.
What is the base price right now?
The base price is $15,000. Yeah. It went from $13,500 to $15,000 last couple years, 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and that includes, I don't add extra for all the shell around the top and the doves and the end wedge joint power shell and the back center strip power shell. That's all included in the price. It's not that much harder to put that stuff on, and to take it off, I don't really discount it any, but some people don't want it on there, just want simpler lines or herringbone or the radial cut Brazilian edging. It's all the same price. What? If you start wanting the peghead back veneer with the perfect lines, and you start wanting the Brazilian head plates with the ebony binding and the white, black, white on the fingerboard and fancier inlays, the radial cut Brazilian rosewood, rosette, that stuff will add to the cost.
Got it. And what woods are you primarily using?
Well, my most popular, of course, is just Indian cedar.
Yep.
And just because it's the one that James Taylor plays, which of course is the reason why anybody even cares about me anyway. So, and Phil Keaggy and Leo, when he played it, and all these people played the same Indian cedar combination. So I build most of those. And then of course, Brazilian, is for the people that want to spend a little more money. And, you know, it is a pretty magical wood, but, I don't know that the extra price is necessary to get more sound or not, but it's there. I would like one if I had a guitar, you know.
Yeah. And do you have a good stockpile of Brazilian?
Well, I have a pretty good stockpile. I actually went to Brazil years ago and bought a pretty good quantity of it. I was very fortunate. And I also had several Brazilian suppliers approach me that I bought from. So, yeah, I do. I do have a pretty good supply. But still, I think my finest pieces, except for some really brilliant quarter sawn ones that I still have, most of my finer wild grain stuff, which isn't always preferable anyway, that's kind of getting picked over a little. But
yeah,
but I have a lot of nice stuff. Yeah,
nice. And where, you know, when I talked to Drew about what he learned from you, one of the things he mentioned that was kind of intriguing for me was that you kind of build with seasons and kind of do these in batches. Where are you at in your current 2016 batch right now?
Yeah, well, actually about 7 years ago, I started trying to take some time off in the winter. It started out being 4 weeks, and it's grown, and now I actually take about 4 months off in the winter. So I'm only working 8 months out of the year. So I will come back in April, escaping the cold Minnesota winters, and I will take on as many orders as hits me within a couple of weeks there of returning, and I'll try to get them built before the end of the year is what they're promised. So this year, like I said, I had 20, and I've got them all out of the spray booth, which is incredibly good. I've shipped about three of them. I have a fellow come and pick one up here on Friday from Atlanta, and the rest of them are all either in the process of getting necks glued on and bridges glued on, or else they're awaiting buff and final buff sanding so they can get to that stage. So they're all getting wrapped up. I'm actually ahead of schedule this year, but bear in mind, last year, before I took off to escape the winter, I braced up a lot of tops, sanded up sides. I didn't bend them, but I glued up backs and tops and put in rosettes and, in some cases, even braced backs and braced tops. So I had a lot of parts made up, and I made up like 200 laminated neck blanks last time I glued those all up, so I'm still culling out of those. When I make bridges or braces, I will make enough braces to last me for 3-4 years. Now, they're just rough shaped. I still have to refine them when you glue them on, but it saves you a lot of initial chiseling. And so I have a lot of parts made up, so that's part of the reason why I can make so many quickly.
Sounds like you could have made 25 this year.
Oh, I could have. I made 40 2 years ago, 42 of them 2 years ago. But actually, that was the year Drew helped me. So that was a tremendous help because I'm telling you, your body doesn't work like it used to. Your mind thinks it can, but you stand at a buffing wheel, 8 hours, 12 hours a day, and your back cramps up really bad. And I've already had rotator cuff surgery, and a lot of people don't know this, but I had polio in my right arm when I was a kid, so my right arm don't work good at all, really, and I use my left arm exclusively for just about everything, sanding. Wow. So it doesn't work as well as it used to, but I still work pretty hard. I work pretty much 7 days a week when I'm here.
And is this a year where you don't have a helper?
I don't have a helper this year or last year, yeah.
Are you kind of over that or done with that?
Well, I kind of needed it because I got greedy and took too much work on. I just wanted to get it done. And I was also having a lot of back problems. So I felt I needed some help. And I met Drew, just a great kid, already pretty experienced. And but it's hard having a helper when you're a one-man shop because they come every day in the morning. And there they are, and they go, what'll I do? And some days you just go, like, get out of my way, you know? And so you end up having to make work some days, you know? It's like, well, why don't you saw up this stuff? Okay, which bandsaw blade? Oh, well, okay, yeah, we got change blades in. You know, which this? So the questions, and by the time you're done, half a day's done before they get working, and you didn't get done what you needed. And now, it's not like that every day, but there are some days, and it isn't fair to the worker either because you feel like you're putting pressure on them. And it's really great when you're like gluing in linings, you know, they can come in and glue them for a week straight, or other operations that are kind of mindless.
Yeah.
I like working the same operation over and over. Multiple times, you get so refined at that, so focused, so quick, and the product turns out so much better than going to it cold every time, just once. Now, a lot of people put me down for that, but I always made the comments like painting windows. You just want to pressure wash them all and put it away, and then sand them once and prime them once and clean the brush. You don't want to do it on one window, move to the next, and drag everything out again, you know. So it is more efficient, and I think the end product is actually improved because you get so much better and refined and as you move on. It also, when you build in batches, you'll muscle your way through something that doesn't go well with the jig you're using. it takes a long time to set up this jig. It's not quite accurate, but you know what? I'm only going to do it because I'm doing it this one time. Well, you try to do it 15 times in a row in that jig, and you go, gee, I got to fix this thing. And that's causes you to make better tooling and better fixtures. I'm sometimes more excited about making a new piece of tooling than a guitar, to be honest with you.
Well, I was going to ask about that because you're known for your tooling and your jigs, and I know you've been an amazing resource for, I hear all the time from luthiers, both Drew and Todd Lundberg and everybody. You've been a great resource and help, especially with young builders trying to figure out how they're going to do stuff. How did you end up, let's go back a bit, how you obviously were into tools and woodworking. How did the guitar bug hit you? When did you make that first guitar?
Well, I played guitar when I was young, and I played in the bands, you know, just the typical rock and roll stuff that was going around in the early Stones. And then I wanted to make a guitar, but because I did like fooling around with wood. I was always making stuff, but I just didn't have any real direction. And then in 73, I met Charlie Hoffman. We actually bought a guitar from him for my wife, and he was doing it, you know. I mean, there it was. But I didn't bother him, honestly. I bought this guitar, and I kind of looked around. I didn't go back to even see him again until I had a completed guitar to kind of show it to him. And then we became friends, and so... But the biggest thing that got me going, since I didn't ask Charlie all these questions initially, I built a guitar before I even asked him a question about guitar making, was a book by Irving Sloan, yeah, and one by David Russell Young, and, you know, showed you how to boil a side. That was the biggest problem. How do you bend a side? I actually went to a vocational school to ask the instructor, and he said, I don't know, do you think it's sawn out of a solid piece of wood? Like, come on, even I can see there's no end grain, it's bent. But so that's how I started out with those books. And, you know, I built about 15 guitars, and I couldn't give them away. Nobody had any interest back then, and Charlie was having a hard time, too, selling them. And it didn't say Gibson or Martin. They weren't really interested. I take them to music stores, and they didn't even want me to open the case. But one time I met this fellow, and he said, look, I run a small distributing company. I will be willing to, I distribute in the five-state area through Schmidt Music Stores. I'll buy everything you can make. I go, what? You know, are you serious? He was excited. He said, well, here's the deal. We'll list them for $895. You'll get $447.50. I'll get 10%, and the store will get the other 40%. And I don't want to put them in the stores till I have at least 75 of them.
Wow.
I want to put like 3, 4, 5 in each store. So I worked the next 2 years killing myself. I made 78 guitars in 2.5 years. They finally put them in the stores. They were in malls, and they cracked. They didn't sell. They reduced them in price to like $225. And I ended up repairing them for free, and I'm still repairing them for free. Some of them.
They still show up?
Yeah, they still show up, you know, and they show up on eBay for huge sums, which is crazy. But you know what? During that period, that's when I learned about tooling. It's like, I can sell every guitar I can make. How can I make them faster? And he wants the same guitar. They were all dreadnoughts back then. I haven't even invented the SJ yet. This was from like 79 to 1981 and a half. So I built tooling. You know, I got shapers to help with things, and I just found ways to repeat things quickly and accurately. You know, and back then, sawing fret slots, that's a pretty hard deal, you know. I spent a long time making this jig that would advance a saw that you, back saw that you pulled with your arm, you know, thinking this would be the deal. And I had a machinist friend make an aluminum thing that would drop into the holes and move this carriage that was on bearings for the saw. Well, I realized after doing this, 15 minutes into it, my arm was falling off. It's really hard to saw fret slots in ebony that many times, you know, when I'm looking at 20 boards sitting there. So then I, you know, built 20 saw blades on an arbor that I could slide a table under and saw them all. And so I was always tool-oriented, trying to find ways to get things quicker. And the end result was always to make them better, not just quicker. But the end result of getting that jig was also, they came out better.
And how were you financing all this tooling? Because it sounds like these guitars didn't really sell off the bat.
Well, we were working on a shoestring. I lost money on those 78 guitars, and believe me, we lived so poor. We didn't even have a car for a long time. We lived in a $135 a month house that I was renting, and then I had a shop space I shared with a harpsichord maker and dulcimer maker and a music store. And we just squeaked by, but every penny that I would get, I would put back into some piece of machinery or something. And during that time, my wife worked for a while as a school teacher, taught math to junior high students. She was, so supportive. But we didn't really, her money just went to buy groceries and food, basically. There wasn't much left over, and the little bit I brought in, we bought tools and wrote it off, but there really wasn't much profit. But we survived, you know. And then in 1981 and a half, when the guy pulled the plug on this, I'll buy every guitar you can make, then I was faced with a decision, you know, what do I do now? And I had just joined this church group, an inner city church, wonderful group of people. They did coffee house singing and outreach, and they bought a big old dilapidated building, and they tried to convince me to come in and use the lower level. Well, I helped them rehab the building. So I kind of just put everything on the back burner, moved all my tools in there. I did repairs for the podium, local music store, and others. Did lots of repairs to survive. They gave me free rent. Eventually, they started giving me a salary because I did more work than I did on guitars. But during those years, I still managed to make maybe a dozen so guitars a year for a while. And it wasn't like I was behind a confessional in the cathedral somewhere. It was a industrial three-phase power, lower level with 12-foot ceilings and a big commercial building I was in. But I stayed there until 1992 when they needed to take over the entire building, and then I moved to the property I'm on now. And even back then, I almost considered giving it up because I wasn't making enough money at it to rent a place and try to have a house and everything else. So I tried to find a place on one property, and I found an incredible place for a pretty good price because the building wasn't finished inside, but it was a 10-acre property with this huge pole building. And that's when everything started to hit, and I was getting deposits from the James Taylor thing. And that's when the money started to come in to help me to finish it out, make the move.
You're probably sick of telling this story, but why don't you tell the story of how you and James Taylor synced up?
I've never been asked that, Jason. Seriously, you're interested in that? I get asked that a lot, obviously. Well, you know, I'm a fan of James Taylor. Who wasn't? You know, I grew up on him, Sweet Baby James album, and I was reading in Guitar Player magazine. He said two things I admire, a boat builder and a guitar maker. I thought, wow, that's cool. You know, I'd love to have him see a guitar of mine, but, you know, I wasn't really confident enough to think anything would come of it. By then, I was building the SJ guitar, and Phil Keggy was playing him, and, you know, he seemed to like him, and he's a monster player.
Yeah. So.
But I really wasn't confident I had any kind of chance. But, like, a week later, I open up the newspaper, and I see he's in town for a benefit concert for the environment with James Brandenburg, the photographer from the National Geographic, and it was going to be with Mark O'Connor, Jerry Douglas, Edgar Meyer, acoustic concert, two nights at the Orpheum Theater. I thought, wow, I wonder if I could show him a guitar. So I called up the promoter at Concerts for the Environment and explained, you know, was there any way I could show him a guitar? And of course, instantly they said, no, we can't do that. We don't have insurance to bring it down. Sorry. I said, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't even have asked. You know, I'm sorry. I just thought I'd give it a shot. It was a lady, and she said, you're not the guy that makes Phil Keggy's guitars, are you? Believe it or not. And I said, well, actually, I am. And then she said, oh, I love Phil Keggy. I just saw him recently, you know. And she said, well, let me call Peter Asher and see what he says. So she called Peter Asher, and she called me back like 30 seconds later and said, yeah, they'd love to see it. Bring it down to the hotel room and leave it there. So I brought it to the hotel room. I don't know if I'm making this too long. I'll just
No, go for it.
Okay, so I brought it down to the hotel room and I left it, and all I did is put a note in the case. I said, James, if you have any interest, please call me. And then I went back, you know, not knowing what to expect. But we did get tickets to go to the Saturday night show. It was unbelievable. I felt like about an inch tall. Why would this guy want anything I make? What am I saying?
What was he playing in that concert? Do you remember?
Well, believe it or not, which surprised me even, he was playing one of those custom Yamahas, and he was under contract with the Yamaha.
Okay.
Most over the pianos, I think. But he was playing Yamaha for about 2 years there. And it sounded good, you know. And it was their more expensive model. It was a really nice custom model. So, but I still felt about that big, just because he's so great of a show. And, you know, Jerry Douglas, come on. You know.
Yeah.
It was just crazy. So I went home, and the next day we had to go to Wisconsin to a confirmation for my brother's kid. And I did not want to leave the answering machine on and come back to a rejection from James, you know, if he even called. Which I doubted he would, but so I turned off my answering machine even. I came back Sunday night, and of course thinking, well, that's it, I'm never going to hear from him. I went into work Monday morning, which was in the church, and my job was to clean the toilets, set up the tables, get ready for the Monday night institute class.
Cause you were a janitor, basically?
Oh, yeah, I was a full-time janitor. That's how I paid my rent.
Okay.
Yep, so I had a little portable phone, not a cell phone, because he didn't have them then, from the base, and I walked upstairs to do my duties. It was Monday, about 10 o'clock. Phone rang. I actually had rubber gloves on because I was cleaning toilets in a woman's bathroom. Phone rang, and he said, is it James Olson there, please? And I said, this is Jim. And he said, well, this is a James Taylor calling? And I said, seriously? And he said, well yes, why? You know, and I was like flabbergasted. I said, well, give me a minute to collect myself here. And he said, you know, we've been playing this guitar all weekend, and I'm quite taken by it. You know, I'm not sure what to do with it. And I was like flabbergasted again. I use that word too much. But so I said, well, you know, I would love to give it to you, but I think you probably can afford it. And Lloyd Baggs once told me, don't ever give anybody anything because they won't appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
If they want it, they'll buy it. So I used that. I just said, I think you could probably afford it. He said, well, yes, that's not the problem. You deserve whatever it is, you know. But he said, I'm interested. Why did you bring a cutaway? I don't use a cutaway. And I said, well, it's the only guitar I had, James, available. I just sort of wanted to show it to you, you know. And he said, well, would you be willing to make me a non-cutaway and a dreadnought? And I said, absolutely, I would love to, you know. And then he said, well, how much do these things cost? Back then it was $2,100 for the one he made. So I told him, and he said, well, that's reasonable. You know, what would I need to do? And I said, well, you need to tell me what you want. He said, no, I'd rather you decide that. You just make it so it sounds and plays like this. And I said, so you don't really care about the appointments? No, I'll leave that up to the luthier, he calls them. And so I set out to build them. But before, let me back up, though. So he said, well, what should I do with this guitar? And I said, well, I tell you what, why don't you pay me for that one? And when we get the other two done, I'll exchange them. He said, that sounds very good, very good. So he took them, and it ended up, I got the other ones done. He wanted to go into rehearsals to see which ones he wanted to keep, you know, before he sent back the cutaway. He's kind of beginning to think he likes that too much. So it ended up, he said, I have to buy all three of them. And his concert tour, they used all three of them that year. That would have been 1991. That's when I first saw him with them, and he had all three on stage and used them. Now he doesn't use the dreadnought as much, but the cutaway and the non-cutaway are still the original ones he got in 1989. So
wow,
they've been through a lot, though. I mean, I've put a lot of repair into them, from airlines to him falling on the end pin and splitting it on a concert in Bonnie Raitt in Italy one time, split the guitar wide open. But they look like they've been through a war, but it would be a crime to refinish them.
Sure.
They're just so weather-checked and finished, worn off the neck, but they still sound and play really well, which is most important.
What finish were you using back then?
Oh, it was nitro, yeah. I didn't go to UV until around 2000.
Okay. And how many, so he only, does he have more than those three guitars now?
Oh, he does, because then... let's see, they were making the live album, and the sound people, I don't even know if James requested it, to be honest with you, but the sound people requested if I had another guitar they could use when they were making the live album, to be able to interchange them quickly if it got out of tune or something. So I provided them another guitar, which I never got back. And then when we got to the signature model stuff, you know, James was, he was excited to have a signature model made, actually, and he didn't want anything. He just said, I said, well, we got to find a way to pay you, you know. No, you deserve it. You deserve it. He's just so complimentary. And I said, well, you know, really, I got to do something for you. And then I said, well, how about this? I'll give you a prototype of each one of them. And his eyes lit up at that. He thought that was, that would be really great. So he had three guitars, one of the series 1, 2, and 3. And then in later years, he got a Parlor guitar that I've only seen him use in concert a few times. But, and that actually was a gift to him by someone who provided the Brazilian rosewood and asked me to make it and give it to him.
Wow.
And I thought, well, all right, I'll do it. He paid me for it, but, you know, he wanted to donate it to James. You'd be surprised how many people approach me wanting to give James stuff, you know. Since it was an Olsen guitar, it was a little self-serving, so I did it.
are you guys like friends, or is it a kind of a strictly business relationship?
We're very good friends when we see each other, but I don't go out of my way to bother or communicate with him. On rare occasion, I'll send him a text. Most of the time, we communicate through his assistant or his guitar tech. But for example, last time I saw him was this recent tour in Mankato, Minnesota. And the first thing he wanted to do was get a picture with me so that he could put it on his Facebook page, which was flattering. You know,
yeah.
I mean, come on, James, seriously? Okay, so he did. I mean, and he's just thrilled to talk to you. But he is so accommodating to everybody that, you know, there just isn't a lot of time to spend with everybody. But when he came out here, he spent, you know, the entire afternoon, evening, and I didn't drive him back down to the hotel till almost midnight. And he had to be up early for a concert in St. Louis the next day.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many of those signature model guitars did you end up building?
Well, we built 100 total. There were 10 Brazilians. I called them a Series 3. They were actually $25,000 each, and they sold out almost immediately.
Yeah.
There were 20 Indians with the same extra appointments. That meant the peghead back veneer, the Brazilian rosette, and the double inlaid doves and the Powell Enfield doves and Owen. And Calton cases included. Those sold out rather quickly, and then there were 80 of the regular version that, like, he played. And I only made these fancier ones just because I knew they'd sell, and he agreed, you know, go for it, make some money for yourself. I mean, it sounds a little bit capitalistic, but, you know, I got to live, too.
Yeah, you were a
yeah.
church janitor not long ago.
Well, and not only that, I'm watching other people capitalize on these things all around me. I was 160 guitars back-ordered after the boom period there. I was still trying to sell them for $37.95, and I took 160 orders at that price. But that's when they started selling. It was 3.5-year wait time. I would deliver a guitar and see it go immediately on eBay for $12,000-$15,000, and they were buying them. And I'm getting trashed in the forums for, you know, who does he think he is, but they didn't realize I wasn't getting that money.
Yeah.
So I didn't make a lot of money during the boom years. Most of those resellers made the money, but when it got to be 2000 and they finally caught up all those back orders, then I just went to what market was getting. A guy called me and said, I'm looking at a used one at Guitar Gal or something. They want $12,500 for it. What can you tell me about it? I said, well, I don't know. I haven't seen it for 15 years. But I tell you what, I'll make you a new one. Well, for $12,500. And he said, well, I thought you weren't taking orders. I said, well, how about you can be the first?
Cause that's just,
well. And within a matter of a month, I think I had 40 orders at $12,500. And it was that's when I started making money and being able to buy the Fidal and the UV cure ovens and update. It was a hard time though. You know, I get a lot of people say, well, yeah, James Taylor started playing his guitar. It's like, I got famous, you know, it's just because of James Taylor. That's true. But, you know, I had to deliver these things. I had to work 7 days a week, you know, 12, 14-hour days, and actually deliver these things. I get calls from guitar makers now that, you know, in the past they would complain because they can't get known and nobody knows about them, they can't sell guitars. Well, suddenly they get a write-up in somewhere and they get 8 orders, 10 orders, and now they're calling me going, I can't build these things. I don't have a good spray booth. The people want their deposits back. And I mean, it's hard to juggle. It's easy to make guitars, really, it is. It's hard to be a guitar maker, though. Make a living at it, juggle the customers, deal with the pressures, and there's always things going wrong. I mean, there isn't any business, I don't care what it is, or life in general, but I mean, with guitars especially, I mean, I don't know who comes in at nights and puts these little dents in the cedar top and all that stuff, but they just show up. It's like you have the thing all set to ship, and you notice something, and then you go to the buffing wheel, and the next thing you know, you got a bigger problem, and there's, it's just lots of, but you know, there's so much reward too. I mean, it's not like I'm complaining, just reporting. It's incredible to walk from your house to your shop and do what you wanted to do, and to create something so cool, you know, that people desire it. And you get guilt by association because famous people get acquainted with them. And I mean, it's crazy. People come in here and actually want their picture with me. Kidding me? It's been quite a story, Jason. I don't know what to say.
Was Phil Keaggy the first kind of well-known musician to take on your guitars?
Well, very very much so, of that caliber. And I didn't know a whole lot about Phil. I knew that he had an album out called Flipside with a lot of electric on it and some acoustic on the other. But this guy talked me into going to the concert and trying to bring a guitar to show him. And back then, I really didn't, like, do that sort of thing. But I went, and I was just blown away. I'd never heard anybody play like this. It was just Phil and a fellow named Peter York, acoustic. And, oh, my gosh, I was just blown away. And oddly enough, Phil was playing on a Mark Whitebook guitar, which was, of course, James' guitar for years. But we went backstage to show it to Phil, and he was pretty impressed. And he ended up having me make one, but then when he got it, he said, you know, can you make me a cedar top? Phil actually ordered the very first cedar top guitar I ever made, and I changed my bracing around for it. I opened the X way up, and I moved all the transverse braces, and I did some weird stuff, and I got it done, and I really didn't know if I made it better or I didn't, but he liked it, and he played that 1984 Olsen up until... I think around 95 when it had been so road-worn, he didn't really want to take it on the road anymore. I made him a new one. I gave it to him just because I'm so appreciative of Phil. I know Lloyd said don't give him away, but at this point, you'd give him anything, you know. He's been so loyal to you all these years. So he's playing the newer one now. He's still got the other one, but he just doesn't take it on the road.
Yeah, and then when did Kotke come along?
Around 91 or 2. Leo called me one day and wanted to come out to have me work on his Taylors. Played one of my guitars, and we ended up, he bought it. He paid for it. He paid for it on payments, actually, which was kind of fun. But Leo's just one of the greatest guys. I think he would rather lie to you than and insult you. He played that guitar for quite a long time, but I think it caused problems with his hand, to be honest with you. And, you know, that's at least what he told me. The neck profile was pretty thin. I was making really thin profiles. David Wilcox wanted a really, really thin one, so I started going thinner because people told me they liked David's, and all of a sudden people are telling you it's too thin, you need to go fatter. You know, if you listen to the last comment that people give you, you'll just go around in circles.
Yeah.
At some point, you just got to make what you make the best and you like the best, and then it will find a market. Because, you know, I don't know the best sound. I know what I like, but I find that if you bring a person in here and you have 5 guitars for them to try and they can take either one of the 5, they'll play each one of them in a circle around and around, and first they'll like this one, then they'll like that one, then they'll eventually look at you and say, what's your favorite? And, you know, it's very rarely cut and dry. This one is what it is, and therefore make this one. Everybody will love it. It just doesn't go that way. So I build what I like. I play very lightly. I play like James. I like a lot of peripheral, sparkle versus fundamental. And Bill Collins used to joke with me, oh, you build those floppy guitars. Because we had a lot of fun together joking about that. But it's sort of true, you know. I mean, they're not a heavy-handed banger's guitar, the Cedar Tops anyway. And that's what I'm sort of most known for. But I don't even know your original question, Jason.
I was just kind of, well, I don't remember that original question, but I am.
I think it was Bill Kagi. When did Kotke come along? That's what it was.
But yeah.
Leo played it for a number of years, and then he did an Austin City Limits with it and was on written up in acoustic guitar with it, and I was pretty proud of that. And I still see Leo on occasion. In fact, I'm expecting to see him in the next couple of days here.
You said that he might have been getting some hand problems from the neck on that guitar.
Yeah.
Do you alter your neck profile to a customer?
Well, I do. Okay. I have three. When I went over to the Fidal, before the Fidal, they were all over the place because you were doing them just by templates and things, you know. And as you're rasping them out, sometimes one gets a little thinner, and sometimes people would say make one a little bigger. And so if a person says, I want somebody's neck from 1996, you know, my friend so-and-so, I couldn't tell you what it was. But now I can. I have for all the different widths from, you know, 1 and 11 up to 1 and 7/8 at the nut, and I have three different thicknesses for each neck. But I'll tell you what, 99% probably of all the necks I made are what I just call my default neck, and that is the thinnest. So I still have a very low profile, very electric feeling type neck. It's more of an oval than a C or a round. You know, it's a little bit flatter on the bottom and oval shaped.
Yeah. And when did the small jumbo come along?
Well, I first built the dreadnought. You know, tried to copy a Martin like everybody did because I didn't know anything else to do and wasn't very inventive. I'm still not, to be honest with you. And so I built dreadnoughts, and I built, you know, probably 140 of them, and then I built some jumbos, the big old Guild jumbo. I think I didn't trace it, but it was either between a J200 or a Guild. I don't remember which model. And my bridges are very Guild. I mean,
yeah.
I sort of liked the appearance of them, and again, I wasn't very inventive. I don't think I came up with much original, to be honest with you. But I built those jumbos. They were cool. I had a Sunburst Maple jumbo personal guitar with a cutaway I loved for years until a guy talked me out of it. But so I shrunk it down. I thought, okay, I'm going to take this big jumbo and make it small. I thought, what do I call it? I thought, okay, a small jumbo SJ. I wasn't even astute enough to know that there was already a Southern jumbo by Gibson. And maybe others had it, but I called it an SJ, a small jumbo. It was only 15 inches across, but deeper than an OM, so it's a pretty deep body. But tight-waisted, it looked just like the big jumbo, hence a small jumbo. And it after Phil is when that one became really my most popular guitar. And then, of course, with James and everybody that's known as an artist, that's what they play now. I'm looking at my wall here. I don't think there's anybody with a guitar that isn't the small jumbo.
And when was the last time you made a dreadnought?
I just made one. It just shipped. It was one of the 20 in this year. It shipped to Dave Merkin. He's the producer for The Simpsons, and he does those James Taylor videos of those lessons. A great guy, and he's got several of my guitars. And I did not want to make it. He was relentless, so I just finished it. He was very happy. He really liked it.
What was the combination of woods?
It was a cedar top Indian rosewood.
Okay.
It had the same pearl appointments as the James Taylor models. James's dreadnought has a herringbone, but we want the pearl around it. Good player and very good ears, and he really wanted this dreadnought. So.
And I take it he's the reason that an Olsen appeared in The Simpsons that one time?
Yes, that's the guy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got more calls over that than I think when James appeared on Letterman or Leno or anywhere else. Vic Boak called me up and left from Martin, left the message on the machine. I saw your guitar in The Simpsons. You're my hero. Yet he played on the Tonight Show about 2 weeks before that, and hardly anybody commented.
Yeah,
came personally. I mean, anyway.
And then, did your neck joint evolve over the years at all?
No, it didn't. The way I do it evolved, so. I've always used a dovetail, which I don't know if it's smart or not. You know, back then there wasn't much choice. Taylor was starting out with bolt-ons, and but everything was dovetail. But I do my dovetail different because when I cut the body dovetail and then the neck dovetail, I pound it into the body tight, and it mates perfectly, so tight that it takes a rap with a hammer to get it out of there. I never touch that again. I never touch the cheeks or the tongue or the body dovetail. That is what it is. That's how it fits. That's how it's going to fit. What I do from there is I remove material on the top of the neck that stands proud of where it needs to be. So I have a jig that tells me how much I need to. Well, first I put a router right on the guitar top itself, and I make a little reference route where it meets the body. So that gets any cant out of it. It's nice and flush there. Then I have another jig that goes down a little bit past the nut that makes a mark where the other reference would be, where the nut should be setting, but a little bit past the nut. And then I route down to that line. Then I just put it into a jig and route the middle out. And now you have a perfect neck set. Let's say you need a little bit more. Well, then you just go back to the nut end, remove another 1/10,000th off, put it back in the jig. And so I can do that so fast. I can fit, you know, 30 dovetail necks in a day, no problem, have the top surfaces ready. But then it goes into the truss rod slotting and the heel cap fixture, and you have to glue on the ears and another jig to route to get ready for the peg head veneer. And you know, there's a ton of work yet, but I don't like chiseling on the dovetail itself because it changes the fit once you remove anything from the cheeks, you know.
Does that cause problems if there's ever a neck reset down the line, or is it harder
that out? No. It comes out the same. It's just, I mean, some come out so easy because they're so full of shims and gaps. It's nothing to get them out. But, no, I mean, you gotta work at it to get it out. Boy, I'm going to get killed for telling this, but because it's probably so dumb. But I don't take out the 15th fret and drill the hole and go through there for the steam. I actually drill a hole right in front of the 15th fret and steam out that way, leave the fret in, and I plug the hole with little machine-cut ebony plugs that are so invisible. So my dovetail doesn't go as deep into the body or the headblock as anticipated, so it has caused some problems for people that don't inquire first about how to get off an Olsen neck, because they'll drill through the 15th fret and they're into the head block and start steaming, and it doesn't release.
Got it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned...
But I like it better that way. I never liked going through the fret slot and removing the fret and steaming up that area anyway.
No, you mentioned the Fidal CNC machine. When did you get that?
About 1990... gosh, good question. 97 or 8, maybe.
Yeah,
that was quite a deal. I mean, I all my friends said, "Don't do it. You don't know what you're doing. You don't learn to do it first." And I didn't care. I didn't need it. I already had Bill Colling's old neck carving machine. I had, you know, 100 bridges pre-made. I with shapers, but I wanted it, you know, and. Yeah, it's just one of those things you wanted. But I had no idea how valuable it would become to me. And when they brought it, I mean, they bring this thing on a big, giant flatbed up to your thing and weighs 10,000 pounds, and they bring it in and dump it off in the middle of your big room. And, you know, I had to spend the next 2 months getting a whole new transformer outside of my shop because the one on my pole had too much line loss. And you know, then you get a $12,500 program that you got to start trying to figure out how to even make the stupid machine go left and right, up and down, and go to Dunwoody Vocational School and spend, you know, from 10 to 1 o'clock in the morning for the next, you know, 6 months trying to figure it out, and finally throw up your hands, kind of. And I met a young kid that had just incredible computer geometric skills. Never worked on Mastercam in his life. he had Tourette syndrome and even twitched a bit. But he came in for a couple hours a day and would help me with my problems, and was a tremendous asset. I would have never been bright enough to pick it up on my own. And so he worked for maybe 2 years with me, a couple, 3 days a week, a couple hours a day, 4 hours a day sometimes, and got me up to speed on it. But I never realized how valuable it was, not just for making parts, which it is, but for making tooling. I mean, I couldn't wait to remake every piece of tooling I had. I mean, everything. My dovetail jigs, I mean, every jig you could think of, it's like, wow, I can make this out of aluminum. It's accurate. It's fun. I just went nuts. I spent more time rebuilding jigs. But then when I had rotator cuff surgery in later years and shoulders going bad, and I realized you can't, you know, hand shape necks like I did. That's what caused it to go bad in the first place when you're doing 40 in a row and stuff. So I think if it broke, I would quit making guitars. It's sad to say that, but.
Wow.
You know, I'd get it fixed, but, I mean, you know, it's just become that valuable to me. And it doesn't do all that much, to be honest with you. I mean, it does not touch my braces. It doesn't touch my top except for cutting the rosette grooves. That's the only thing it cuts. It doesn't touch the back at all. It doesn't touch the sides being bent. Doesn't touch the head or tail block at all. The dovetail is cut outside of it. It works on the neck, some inlays, fingerboards. You know, people think you throw a bunch of wood in there and guitars come out, but it doesn't do that much. And even what it does, it only gets it close. You still got to sand it. Yeah. And before I moved a router by my hand, this is just moving a router without your hands, you know. You still had to move a machine to get it that close. Like people say, oh, don't you miss when you used to make them by hand? Well, I never did. My hands aren't very sharp. They don't cut anything. You know, I had to hold routers and machines to move them with my hands or sharp chisels or, you know. But honestly, people would be surprised how little it really does do, except for tooling. I mean, that would blow them away if they saw the tooling I made.
Yeah. You've mentioned you want to slow down. Are you still working on making new tooling and jigs, and are you always trying to refine this process?
You never stop. There are still plenty of things that don't work the way they want and that I would like to improve on. But, you know, you're running out of time. On a scale of 1 to 8, I got about, 1.4 left of good, maybe, you know, if I can make it to 80 strong. You start thinking less about the future and in guitar making and more about the future and how can I enjoy what remains, you know.
Yeah.
Got grandkids now and I have money now, you know. I mean, I did pretty well now. But it is so much a part of me that I don't know what you do when you don't make guitars. When I go to go away or take off in the winter, you know, I'm anxious to get back to it. That's why I come back fired up and take too many orders again. But there are so many things in life that are worthy outside of guitar making, and the first you know, portion of my life was consumed with it, so much so it was unhealthy, really. I mean, it was just way too consumed with it. But I have good kids, and they knew where I was, but I didn't see them a lot. My wife took them to the ball games and to all that stuff. I got the best wife in the world, by the way.
It sounds like it.
When I used to go to conventions where I had to speak or something, the first thing I do when I got up is I said, in order to be, people always ask me, what's the most important thing you need to be a guitar maker? And I would say, well, you don't need one of these, but if you have one, it better be a really, really good one. And then I'd show a picture of my wife. Because if you could probably make guitars without a wife, but you aren't going to make guitars if you don't have a good wife, because she's going to leave you for alienation of affection in about the first week, because she doesn't get much from you.
Do any of your kids, did they want to take up the world of guitar building?
No.
No. Or did you steer them away?
No, I steered them away, you know. I mean, I was too impatient. I was too behind. And also, they were just too afraid to come out here. But I tried sometimes, you know. I'd bring them out, and I'd say, well, look, you know, here, you just glue this kerfing in like this, and they do it for about an hour and then go, but Dad, we don't want to do this, you know. So that was just fine. I have great kids. My oldest boy is a professional musician with a master's degree. He plays flute, clarinet, saxophone, and the broad type shows. And my middle kid's a drummer in a rock and roll band and works in another job on to supplement. And my youngest is a senior program engineer for computers.
Wow.
They're all great kids and doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you go down to Arizona, do you whittle or do any woodworking at all?
Oh.
No.
No. I hike a lot. I play golf, even with my bad arms. It's really weird. My polio arm just goes along for the ride.
Yeah.
And I've met so many great people over the years and have had so many opportunities. The reason I started to say that, I won't even go into it. I was going to say John Daddario from Daddario Strings is a neighbor of mine not far away, and so I get to play golf with him. How cool is that?
That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking your time. This was great.
This is going to be the most jumbled podcast you've ever had. I don't even know what I talked about. But, Jason, it's good talking to you, and I hope somebody enjoys something out of this, what it'll be. But I don't even know if I want to listen to it. Phil Kagi once told me I sound like Garfield and then did an imitation of me. So. But anyway, good talking to you. I love your magazine, by the way. I've been a subscriber since issue one.
And
I think it's fabulous.